Waddle working his way back. It seems like he might be available for the national championship game in 11 days. Hurtling is Harris, and now running down the sideline. And he's chopped out of bounds deep in Irish territory. That's a man of 6'2", 230, who went up and over Nick McLeod.
This is High Motor by BetMGM. Andrew Doughty and Chase Kitty breaking down betting numbers on BetMGM.com, talking football, talking basketball, talking a little Sardinia tennis sprinkled in, expanding that audience overseas. Looking forward to today's pick. You told me before the show that it's a little contrarian, so I'm curious, when you use the word contrarian, I think it's more loosely. When I say contrarian, I'm thinking, hey, let's talk tennis. Let's talk lacrosse. When you, sir, use contrarian, I expect you to go way off the map. So I'm looking forward to today's pick, hoping we do go off the map. That'll come a little bit later.
Let me rein you back in here just a little bit here at the top. Lower your expectations just a little bit.
So we're not going beyond Sardinian tennis.
No, it's going to be contrarian in nature, not in magnitude of sport.
I was hoping maybe we go darts, Belarusian soccer.
We got to get one of my darts guys on here at some point. We got to, if you want to do a really hot 8 minutes on darts, like, I know the people for that segment.
So I was looking back over our episodes. I mentioned this to you before the show. 7 straight college basketball episodes after we had Michael Jannetty from SpotTrack on to break down NFL free agency almost 2 months ago. About a month ago or so. But we haven't had a true college football episode, an entire episode devoted only to college football, since January 12th after the national championship game. We did have Thor Nystrom from NBC Sports Edge on for NFL Draft Talk a while back. Sam Herder was on right before the FCS season started for a segment, but no college football episode since January 12th. So that's what we're going to do today. We don't have college football win totals yet on BetMGM.com. Those will come here pretty soon, probably after spring ball, hopefully early part of the summer. But question for you, because this is something that you and I have talked about both on the show and offline, your very selective nature about betting on college football win totals, and your hit rate is extraordinarily high. Have you started poking around yet, looking at numbers for this year, or is this still too early for you mid-April?
I haven't really gotten into it too much yet, and I'm not opposed to doing early research and kind of having an idea of the environment before the numbers drop. But for me, I mean, just coming out of the NCAA tournament, we're 7 days removed from the title game right now. I'm more focused on trying to get a feel for the ebbs and flows of where certain NBA teams are at, kind of in this stretch run before the playoffs. And then just looking around, watching pitchers in Major League Baseball, kind of staying away from hockey right now, getting a feel for where clay season is, who's hot, who's cold, who do I want to stay away from. Looking at starting pitchers, I'm more in that camp right now than digging into returning rosters. But I do probably want to get into that before the month of April is out. April or May, start looking around what teams are unsexy but bringing a whole lot of production back from the 2020 season. That is certainly something I want to look at in the coming weeks.
Can we do 3 minutes here? I know I just plugged this as an entirely college football episode, and I'm sure what you talk about with this question I'm going to ask you is going to be kind of related to college football generally too, in addition to other sports. But you mentioned coming off college basketball, in which we had 67 games over a 2.5 week stretch. And even though we did pretty well, I think you said we went 18-6 over that time. Generally, like, you're going to lose a lot of bets during college basketball season, especially during the NCAA tournament, just because there are so many different games you can bet on. And you've talked about in the past that, yes, you don't want to lose bets, but, like, that's going to happen. When you go on and you bet the NCAA tournament, whether if you bet 10, 25, or all 67 games, like, you're going to lose bets. We still lost 6 out of 24, but that's a pretty darn good hit rate. Now going into kind of getting a feel for NBA, trying to feel out the early part of the MLB season, like, what is your, I guess, like, bankroll management strategy here, coming off of all those games and then trying to rein yourself in, do a little bit of research before you jump into a new sport. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Self-awareness and humility are really important in gambling. And I think that's really important to remember constantly, because gambling is such an alpha male thing, or at least it can turn into that, where you really, you're feeling yourself and you think you're the man, and that, you know, the profits are just going to come in indefinitely. And you have to check yourself from that. So I'll give you an example. Coming off a great tournament season, I'm like to be a little conservative by nature. I like to be more regimented when I bet. So I took this week, I picked my spots carefully, but I took some shots. I went and bet, you know, a fair amount of baseball totals, a lot of underdogs, some NBA stuff. And then Sunday afternoon, before we were initially going to sit down, we're actually recording this Monday morning, but we usually record Sunday. I kind of sat down and looked at what I had done over the previous week, and I saw some patterns. And I saw, like, for example, picking baseball sides, picking winners and losers. I was like 10-3, up 9 units in 7 days. So very, very good. On the other hand, looking at totals across basketball and baseball for that week, I had been like 2-6 and lost 5 units. So I want to focus on the things that I'm good at. It's not to say I'm never going to bet a total again. It's just I'm a little shaky out of the gate on some of these numbers. Historically, I'm really good at NBA totals. Maybe didn't have a great week. So let's get back to the lab. Let's figure out what I'm doing wrong, what assumptions I'm making. Doesn't mean I'm not going to bet any more baseball totals. I've got 2 on deck for today. I'm betting over 9.5 in the day game between the Twins and the Red Sox, and I'm on the under 9 in the Yankees-Blue Jays game. So I'm right back to the well, but I tweaked what I was doing a little bit, and that is an important thing to remember, is check yourself, look at how you're doing, look in the mirror, readjust, and maybe I'm going to focus this week more on the sides and less on the totals, because that's what I seem to have a good feel for coming out of the gate, more so is the sides and picking the right underdogs in baseball. And I'm going to readjust how I'm attacking these totals, be maybe a little more conservative, pick a couple fewer spots on these baseball totals. Try to stay in the black.
So the other day when we were trying to figure out what we were going to talk about, because this feels like the first real like off-season episode for us, you described this episode maybe as a setting the table, like a preseason episode for college football. And that came, I think, after I had texted you an article about Dave Dorian nearing an extension with NC State. And I sent that not because I really care about Dave Dorian or NC State, but I think it's a good way to start a conversation about teams that just kind of settle for mediocrity. And he's 55, 46, and 8 years at NC State. For those of you who don't care about NC State football, just hang on here. This is the lead into a broader conversation we're going to have about college football. Dave Dorian, 55 and 46 in 8 years. He has 2 8-win seasons, 2 9-win seasons, only 28 and 38 in the ACC, only once finished better than third in the Atlantic. He wanted that Tennessee job way back when they hired Jeremy Pruitt. That whole situation, the deal was basically done. Then it seems like the Vols went dark on him. So he's kind of openly campaigned for another job while he's been there, which isn't uncommon, but still worth noting. And with another extension coming, it seems like there's really no question. We never know exactly what's going on in these rooms and why programs are signing extensions. But from afar, it seems like there's no question NC State is saying that, hey, we're good with this. You know, we're good with whatever the 55 and 46, 28 and 38 in the ACC. We're good with that. It's maybe marginally better than we've been historically. Has he exceeded expectations at NC State? Probably not. He's probably met expectations going into the tenure. He's running a very clean, a stable, law-abiding program that's not the subject of NCAA investigations or any other external reasons why they should fire him. They're saying we're good with that. Instead of paying a buyout and going after maybe a higher-ceiling guy, you know, we're kind of good with going to the Gator Bowl every few years, going to mid-level bowl games. And I mean, for me as a fan of a shit program, I would do anything for that. I mean, like, take any one of my fingers or any limb that you want, and I'm in for an annual competitive program like that. I want to see annually competitive program of football. And NC State just isn't that type of program. Like, they're not a bad program. Good recruiting area, good stadium, pretty good school. And to me, this is just settling for what they are right now. There's a lot I want to get into with this, starting with a question that you've kind of brought up in varying contexts before. You've screamed about this in varying contexts before. When somebody says, like, college football is better when Notre Dame is good, or college football is better when Nebraska is good, when Miami is good, when Ohio State is dominant, when whomever is good, you've yelled about that on the show a lot. Let me ask you a version of that. Is it better or is it worse for college football when programs settle for a certain level of mediocrity like NC State is doing? Like, is it better or worse when we have a program like NC State, a reliable 7-9-ish win program that's going to finish right at maybe a little bit above 500 in the conference most years, never really be a true player in the national picture, never really be a true player in the conference championship race? Is it better for that, or like, is it better for a program that's unwilling to accept mediocrity and instead takes their shots at higher ceilings? Do you even have an answer to this, or are you pretty indifferent on how college football is kind of made up of different types of programs willing or unwilling to settle for mediocrity?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I've ever considered that before. So here's what I would say. I think it's really cool. I'll start here. I think it's cool that NC State is comfortable with this, because there are so many programs, so many fan bases. I would throw my fan base into that. There are a lot of West Virginia people that are like, hey, why aren't we winning the national championship? And it's like, okay, well, that's not really how it works. Hey, I'm glad we're not in the Big East anymore. I'm glad we got off the Titanic when it was sinking. But there's a big difference between perennially contending in the Big East and perennially contending in the Big 12. It's not quite the same thing. So I think it's great that NC State institutionally knows who it is, has a sense of self, looks around and goes, hey, if we can consistently be 8-4, 9-3 in the ACC, like, that's pretty good. That's about what we should be. Let's see if we can just consistently hit that mark. Because that's a skill. Being able to consistently be good, not great, but good, that's a talent. I not everybody can do that. I think your question supposes that there is another, like, lane that they could try, and I'm not necessarily sure that's the right way to look at it. Like, what's the personnel hire that NC State makes where there is inherently more risk? Like, it's almost like a video game, the way you're framing it. Like, I can accept a larger degree of high probability risk, but like, the roll of the dice might turn out where we go 4-8 this year instead of 10-2. And like, ooh, I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know that people necessarily work like that. I don't know, like, I don't know anything about the intricacies of NC State or Dave Doran. Like, I don't know what his approach is or what his vision for what a 12 months under the NC State season look like. But I would imagine, based on the results, that it's very steady. That he probably does a lot of the same things, makes a lot of similar decisions year over year. Like, that's kind of what I'm envisioning. And I think at a program like NC State, like, or I think the program you were probably referencing, Kansas, or maybe Minnesota, but probably Kansas.
Yeah, I think it was Kansas, actually.
Yeah. I mean, one of them has not been great. The other one's been pretty bad. I think if you're at like a program that doesn't have that kind of momentum, I mean, you could argue that just having the momentum is the positive takeaway, is being 8-4 consistently over and over again. That's a good thing. I would argue if you want to get to that 10-2 place, you have to build momentum over time at a place like NC State. I don't think NC State's going to be the next Clemson, but if you go back and look at what Clemson was doing 10 years ago, they were consistently trying to be like, not let's be 8-4, 9-3. Let's be in the Orange Bowl every year, every other year. Like let's keep building, let's keep building. Now Dabo's a really good coach, so I'm not trying to say NC State's on that kind of path, but I do think if you wanted to make a case for becoming an elite program without any real previous recent history of doing that, you would probably attack it like this instead of taking some sort of like ethereal magical risk quotient. I think it would be more like we need to build consistency, and then if we can add some top level talent and like,
God, that's a good point. That's
get a, really a good recruiting class in here and sort of sprinkle a few 4- and 5-star recruits that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise. That's how you get to that next level, I would think.
That's a really good point. I didn't think of it that way. And as you were kind of talking about it, I started to scan my brain really quickly for, okay, let's say they do take a shot and I don't know, like Shane Beamer just comes to mind because I think like during our neighborhood series, and I'll pull it up again, we kind of like very loosely compared NC State and South Carolina based on like the resources and potential. South Carolina has a better job, I think, with a higher likelihood of actually competing for a playoff spot. But let's just use Shane Beamer, for example. Let's say they fired Dave Dorian and went after Shane Beamer. I don't know if he would have taken that job. Probably not. In hopes of getting over the hump. Let's say he does that. Like in year three, Shane Beamer goes 12-1 and they maybe don't make the playoff, but they finish fifth. Shane Beamer is gone. Like he's going somewhere else. Whereas if you have a guy like Dave Dorian and maybe they get to a point where they're a 10-2 consistently, like they're a very consistent top 12, top 13, top 14 team. And maybe Dave Dorian isn't that guy, but he gets them to a point where this is a really attractive job. It's not one of the best 5 or 10 jobs in college football, but it gets to a point where this is a really strong top 25 job. He leaves the program in much better shape than when he arrived. And then they go get whomever. Maybe it's, you know, Mike Norvell's not a good example now, but maybe it was they go and get like a Memphis Mike Norvell, where you go get that guy, a great fit. Maybe he's an alum. Maybe he's a good geographical fit. You have a better chance of hanging on to him long term to get you over the hump. And the only example, I don't know if this is a good example of it or not, but I started thinking about Oregon because when Mike Bellotti got there, and I pulled it up, he got there in 1995. Oregon wasn't really anything. I mean, they were the type of program that NC State used to be. I know they had some success under O'Brien and a little bit before then, but they were generally like the 4, 5, 6, 7 win team. And Bellotti started building them up, you know, winning 8 games, 7 games, 8 games, you know, a 10 win season every few years, to the point where I'm sure, and I'd have to go back and actually look at how the public and how Oregon stakeholders were reacting to Bellotti, and a little bit different there with his, you know, because I think he became the AD afterwards. So that was a little bit different, but like, did Oregon want more at that time when Mike Bellotti was just going like 7-6, 8-5 back in 2002-03, were Oregon people saying, you know, let's take a shot, let's take a swing and go get somebody. I mean, Chris Peterson wasn't Chris Peterson back then, but let's go get a guy like that and find our guy to get us over the hump. But instead, Oregon stayed with Bellotti. They got to the point where they were winning. I mean, he won at least 9 games in 3 or 4 years before he technically retired. 9 games in 2007 and 10 games in 2008. And then they promoted Chip Kelly. Again, a little bit different. They didn't go out and get like some guy that's going to, you know, try to get their ceiling up. But maybe that's kind of the point with NC State, what you were making. Let's have Dave Dorian get us to that point. Because I don't know if NC State necessarily settling for mediocrity, or maybe they just see another gear with Dave Dorian that isn't necessarily playoff contention, ACC contention every year, national championship contention. But maybe they see the next gear of, he can get us to 10-2, and we'll talk about some other programs that are kind of in this similar boat here in a minute, but maybe he can get us to 10-2, and then we go find our Shane Beamer, our Mike Norvell, our Scott Frost, that type of coach. I think you made a really good point with that. I don't know if that's what they're doing. Maybe that's what they're doing, but it still seems right now that they're kind of settling for where they're at. Are there any other programs that you think that kind of fall under this category of not necessarily settling like for mediocrity, but let me give you an example. One of them that I thought was Oklahoma State, because I don't know if Oklahoma State is settling for mediocrity, but they're settling for what they clearly are under Mike Gundy. And I'm not sure if another coach could come in there and do a better job, like if they brought in a Jamie Chadwell or a Will Healy or somebody. I don't know if that would necessarily get them over the hump into annual Big 12 championship contender, playoff contender. But I think that it's reasonable to say that a lot of people around Oklahoma State would want to take that shot, knowing that this is what Mike Gundy is. And as you said, going into last year, if Oklahoma State's not going to win the Big 12 this year, when the hell are they going to do it? So it's not even like a case of settling for mediocrity, because I don't think Oklahoma State's a mediocre program at all. It's just settling for what you've been for so long under a certain coach that should they be taking a bigger shot here to get to that next level?
And it's frustrating to think about this in the context of your own team. Because if you're an Oklahoma State fan, you don't want your ceiling to be like the 20th best team in college football. Like that's not where you want the road to end. But from a larger perspective,
do you remember where we put, I pull up the neighborhood series. Do you remember where we put Oklahoma State off the top of your head?
Third or fourth, probably.
They were fourth. So they were alongside, those of you who didn't listen to it, I'd recommend it because it's kind of just an evergreen segment. We put basically every college football team in the country into these neighborhoods of where they sit in the college football hierarchy. And Oklahoma State was in the fourth neighborhood alongside USC, Florida State, Washington, Iowa, Virginia Tech, those kind of teams.
Yeah, and that's a good place to be. Like, right. Especially right. When, just to be objective here, like the power and the energy for football in that state is not in Stillwater. So the fact that they kind of survive that and are still not just relevant, but legitimately good year after year. Yeah, maybe they don't win championship games in their conference, but they're still good and they're still relevant. Like, there's a lot of teams that would want to be that. So I understand if the administration goes, you know what, we could take a shot here and maybe it turns out better, but maybe it turns out worse. And you know what? We kind of like being good every year. The odds are that Oklahoma State's not going to be the next Alabama. Like, that's probably not going to happen. So sticking with the guy that has built your program over the last, 15 to 20 years, that consistently wins 8, 9, 10 games. Sometimes maybe they get a rivalry win. Sometimes they're competing for a conference championship. That's pretty good. And not everybody gets to do that.
I think it's important here to say, kind of, I don't even know if either of us have given like a very firm opinion, but like from a curiosity standpoint, and just because I don't like Mike Gundy as a human being that much, I wouldn't mind seeing Oklahoma State taking a shot. Like, I'd be curious how Jamie Chadwell would do there. I'd be curious how, we're both very high on Will Healy. I don't know if he's ready for a job like that yet, but from purely like a fan entertainment curiosity standpoint, yeah, I would love to see them take a shot. I think it's better for entertainment purposes for programs to take a shot and try to get up there. From like an internal perspective and understanding what you are, a financial perspective, however you want to put it, I totally understand why NC State's doing what they're doing. I totally understand why Oklahoma State is doing this. I understand why like TCU is kind of just letting Gary Patterson like pop up for a Big 12 contention every 3 or 4 years, but then, mostly have a lot of mediocre teams. I understand like why USC hasn't fired Clay Helton, mostly from a financial perspective. I think if you can't see that, you're probably not looking at the situation correctly. Internally, there are reasons why these moves happen. Even though you and I will blast different hirings and firings and things like that, it's usually easy to see why like a move or why a hiring is happening. In the case of NC State and these teams I mentioned, like, it's really easy to see why they're retaining their coaches, and I don't think USC is happy with winning what they've won. I know the numbers last year are skewed, but they've won 18 total games the last 3 years. Nobody in USC is happy with that, but it's very easy to understand, at least from a financial perspective, why they're doing that. Any other programs come to mind that are kind of just settling for where they're at in college football, and not even that like you dislike it, but you understand why they're doing it?
I don't think I have anything off the top of my head right now, but I do think it is one of the most interesting like collections It's one of the most interesting places to talk about in college football, that like upper middle class of, you know, we talked about the neighborhood thing. You know what we should do at some point as a different bit? We should assign like real world celebrities, millionaires, billionaires, like random people to programs, because the idea that you're like an investment banker that makes 400 grand, like, you got it pretty good. You're better than a lot of other people, but you still probably want to be Jeff Bezos, don't you? You still probably want to get to that next level. That's an interesting way to look at college football, I think, and it would probably contextualize for a lot of people how what you ultimately want as a fan is not always super realistic.
Now that you've lowered my expectations of going off the map here, how far exactly are we going off the map?
So, Andrew, let me ask you this, and I know going in, you're not a heavy NBA guy, but that's actually I think that's going to play well here. When I say right now in April of 2021, the San Antonio Spurs, what do you think of? Like, where would you put them? How good do you think they are? Like, how do you think about that team, that club right now?
Very indifferent to it, because they just lost Aldridge, correct? He's in Brooklyn?
He is now in Brooklyn along with half of the NBA.
From my very limited experience around the NBA, they are struggling to find some sort of identity since the whole dynasty was broken up, right?
That is absolutely correct, and that is absolutely what I thought you would say. Because that's how most people feel about him, right? That is what people think of the Spurs, is kind of past their expiration date, past their prime, looking for an identity, don't really know what to do now. So it is unsurprising to me, but maybe surprising to others, when I find that San Antonio is 15-6 against the spread this year as a favorite, because people are reluctant to lay points with them.
What was the number, 15-6-1, you said?
15-6 against the spread.
They've been
season.
A favorite in 21 games.
They have.
See, that seems high, too. Because what are we, 50 games into the season, roughly?
We're about that, yeah.
Wow, see, that's surprising that they would be a favorite in almost half of their games. Granted, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the San Antonio Spurs, but that number alone surprised
40% of their games.
But I'm sure that's what you're getting at here.
Yeah, it's... People are reluctant to lay points with the Spurs because they have that idea that, well, they're not very good anymore, so why am I going to lay points? That creates value. So when I say it's a contrarian pick, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You're finding value in a place where other people sort of at first glance are reluctant to go. 15-6 is a favorite. Enter a Monday night contest with the Orlando Magic, who were just gutted at the trade deadline. So this is, admittedly, maybe a more obvious spot to play them as a favorite, because they're going on the road against a team that just lost a lot of their best players, and they are laying 6 points in Orlando. Nonetheless, I'm going to lay the 6 with the Spurs. The line is kind of all over the place here. I'm going to grade it at 6. I imagine because of the pro money that's coming in, this could go up as the day goes on. You might go up to 6.5 or 7. But I like the Spurs here, following the contrarian trend, laying the points in Orlando.
This is something that you and I don't love saying, is what's not really getting enough attention. I'm not sure if this comes from, you know, multiple decades of listening to Ryan Russillo kind of scream about this, because if you want to look for information, like, everything is out there. So when we say not everybody is talking about this, it's a really high bar to kind of hit. But in our case, since we haven't done a college football episode, it's April 12th right now, exactly 3 months ago, I think it applies to us here, because you and I, even though I've kind of been keeping an eye on different college football developments, obviously the coaching hires and how they put their staffs together and going into spring ball, but still, because most of our attention has been focused on college basketball and elsewhere, we can really, you know, sincerely ask this question, like, what hasn't received enough attention specifically from us on this show since the national championship game, since that last episode of January 12th? I have a few things here. Does anything stand out to you right off the top that maybe we missed or just hasn't got enough attention over the last 3 months?
Yeah, I was kind of going back through the conference standings and just looking around, looking at some of the more basic analytic numbers, trying to get a feel for how and where teams ended the season, and if that felt different than just the feeling I had from them in season. So I'll give you an example of that. Like Mississippi State, Gundy.
Basically the same person, right?
Honestly, it's not that. Yeah,
not that different.
Not that different. That's a great point by you. You go down to Starkville, and they start so out of a cannon with that LSU game, right? And you're thinking, oh man, pirate captain taking the SEC by storm. Well, or they could finish 3-7. At the very bottom of that division, and that
score
LSU
30
game
points.
Is just
they
basically
scored 30
an aberration.
Points. 30 points over a four-game stretch.
I mean, yeah.
They scored 30 points.
What more do you want? I mean, that's more an indictment of the LSU coaching staff, if you ask me, than it is anything positive about Mississippi State's offensive potential in the long term. So I think that's like an example of what I was looking for. Maybe you attacked this a little bit differently, but I've got a few notes here on just, you know, like, hey, maybe adjust your expectations for this team up or down going forward, because maybe the reality doesn't line up with how you remembered the season.
I'm glad that you mentioned that right off the top, because I have a few different ones, one of which fits exactly into that right there, and that's Purdue, because they kind of they didn't start the season with like as headliner of a win, and it was different dates on this because of Big Ten started a little bit later, but they beat Iowa on that late touchdown 24-20 in week one. And even though we didn't like know if this was going to be an Iowa team that I'm just using general numbers here because the games were limited last year, we didn't know if this was going to be another Iowa team that went like 10-2 or was just going to be an Iowa team that goes 7-5. Regardless, we knew that this was a pretty decent Iowa team. And it felt like we were saying, oh, I mean, you know, they had a rough year. Purdue had a rough year basically ever since they beat Ohio State and Iowa two wins in 3 weeks back in 2018. They didn't have a great year in 2019. Now they beat Iowa. And I think that the general feeling was, hey, maybe like this is what Purdue is. Maybe they have figured it out a little bit. They're going to come out and make a bowl game, finish. I didn't know what they were scheduled to play, I think, 7 or 8 games last year. I can't remember. All these numbers are so off in my head because I haven't even looked at it. It feels like we're all thinking maybe this is Jeff Brohm kind of getting back on the saddle and being fine again. It turns out Purdue sucked again last year. Like, again, since they beat Iowa and Ohio State twice in 3 weeks back in 2018, they're 7-15 overall. And we're only 2 years removed from Jeff Brohm being like the guy in college football, the whole Louisville search, and like he was one of the top 2 or 3 candidates for any job across college football too. I'm going to stop short of saying like he should be on the hot seat here, but I don't think it's getting enough attention that like they have, I don't know if they've imploded really since then, but like they haven't done shit since those two games once we get to the season here almost 3 calendar years ago. And I think that kind of mirrors with Mississippi State, where everyone was all over Mike Leach. And I think after this Iowa game, I think Jeff Brohm was getting a pretty good amount of credit for that. And it turns out like Iowa wasn't that great and Purdue wasn't good. And in terms of LSU and Mississippi State, kind of the same deal with that. And again, I don't want to put like Jeff Brohm in the hot seat, but I don't think that him going from where he was as like the candidate in college football to now having done nothing over the last 2.5 years is getting enough attention this offseason as a coach and as a program that we need to really watch closely to see if they're still actually going to be moving forward at some point as a program, or if they're continuing to just kind of like deteriorate into like this 4 or 5 win program.
I co-sign all of that because I too had Purdue written down on my list wondering like, man, a couple years ago, this was supposed to be like, hey, you got the players at the top of the Big Ten. And then right after that, Purdue on deck, like they are putting some stuff together.
Weren't you all over the, before all the cancellations, weren't you all over, I think we laughed about it, the Purdue total?
Oh, yeah, it was like 7.5. And I was like, yeah. know. Like, what are you talking about?
That's why I'm curious when these numbers come out on BetMGM.com, hopefully here in the next month or so, we can look at that and get a better idea of where the odds makers think the public falls on Purdue. And I should glance around to kind of just generally see early Big Ten rankings, the general perception of Purdue. But it still seems like we don't realize, like, what Purdue has actually done over the last 2 years. And, like, they're not a Big Ten player. Like, they are so far buried in the Big Ten right now, and that's probably not getting enough attention.
Can we keep it in the Big Ten? Because I have other hot takes about Big Ten schools.
I'd love to.
How good was Indiana last year?
And not even in the sense of, yeah, Penn State turned out they were just trash. I'm not sure if the players quit or if they weren't good at all. But
well, I'm going to come around to Penn State here in a moment, but to start with Indiana, like, that overtime win with the dive at the pylon, and was it good or was it not, 36-35, at the sort of the beginning of the Big Ten season that everybody talked about for like four straight days, we used that like heavyweight down to the wire win over then number 7 ranked Penn State as the benchmark for, oh man, Indiana, we think they're pretty good. They just beat Penn State. Then we
got. Are you actually asking me, like, do we know how good Indiana was this year? Or are you saying, does everybody realize that Indiana was really good?
I'm saying, I don't know how good they were. So we get confirmation bias because they beat Michigan, who was ranked in the top 25 at the time. They have a final score with Ohio State that was a 7-point margin. They end the season by losing to Ole Miss. Now, I don't always want to put stock in bowl games, but like the fact that some of those markers, I think statistically you would acknowledge, were kind of flawed and that maybe we overhyped some of them, combined with losing to Ole Miss, I don't know that I'm ever going to know which way I should feel about this Indiana team. And reminder that before the season last year, I was all over the Indiana thing. Like, I loved their win total. I thought they were being undervalued. Now I feel like I look back and I'm not, I don't, maybe they were good. Maybe they were really good. And I like everything that's going on with that program. And I think they'll continue to be sort of a top half Big Ten team. But I don't know, man. I don't think they were as good as we thought they were.
Is it fair to... And one of the things that I want to say that I don't think is getting enough attention over the last few months is the eligibility thing and how rosters are just going to look differently this year than they've ever looked in the past. And like, even during college basketball, maybe I'll just talk about that really quickly right now. Even during college basketball season, like, I get on the NCAA tournament show when the NBA guys didn't even know the eligibility rules. I'm just going to kind of throw that out because they shouldn't be doing those shows anyways. And I understand why that came up and why they didn't know the rules. But like, it seems like we're not talking enough about how much different this year is compared to a normal year with so many guys getting that extra year of eligibility. And yes, you have a lot of guys that declined it or transferred or whatever, but we also had staff turnover and all that, 17 new head coaches in college football. But teams that would ordinarily struggle with, like, maybe Indiana is a good example, struggling with replicating the success of a strong season, at least win total wise, because they haven't built up the depth to replace those players yet. Like, I don't know how this is going to play out because it's not like only the lower tier schools have the benefit of returning seniors. Like, every program has it. Like, even players in Alabama and Clemson and Notre Dame are taking advantage of an extra year, and the staffs don't have to replace those players. But it still feels like a huge storyline that's not really mentioned. Like, I couldn't believe how, like I said, how little the eligibility thing was mentioned during college basketball season, and how often I read of like potential departures and, oh, this guy's going to graduate. Well, no, he's like, technically, yes, he's graduating, but that has nothing to do with his eligibility. So I'm surprised at how little attention they got there. And that kind of led me into going back and wondering, like, why we're not talking enough about college football. Like, does that mean that Coastal Carolina, for example, maybe that's a better example, is going to be just as good with their returning players that wouldn't normally return? Like, in a normal year, would Coastal Carolina now dip back down in the Sun Belt, have like a, you know, 7-5 year, we won't really talk about them? I don't know. Like, I don't know where I'm at with this, but I feel like it's not getting enough attention because we don't know, like, how to talk about it and how to react to it in terms of the returning players. And maybe in Indiana's case, maybe we evaluate the season. I don't know if this is fair or not. Maybe we evaluate the season once we get into 2021. Like maybe if they go to Iowa City and win in the opener, I think they have them. Yeah, they're at Iowa week one, and they have Cincinnati in week three. So maybe if they go to Iowa and then beat Cincinnati or at least play Cincinnati well in week three, then we can go back and say, yeah, maybe this Indiana team was pretty good. Whereas in a normal year, and I don't know how many seniors Indiana has coming back this year that wouldn't normally come back. In a normal year, I don't know if it's really that fair to kind of like put off our evaluation until the next year and say, well, they weren't really good last year because now they're struggling this year. But maybe that is the case with Indiana because of all the players they have coming back, presumably coming back, and you look at their roster breakdown. Maybe that's the fair way to do it. If they do play well against Iowa, they do play well against Cincinnati, and then they go into Big 12 play, Penn State, Michigan State, Ohio State. Like, is that fair to put off the evaluation a full 9 months until this upcoming year?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be the most unprecedented, complicated, tough to predict offseason really in modern college football. So I do think a wait and see, more conservative approach is probably, I mean, pretty intelligent in terms of, you know, not over predicting. I think the one really interesting element to this that I don't think you mentioned was, yes, we have all these returning players, but everybody has returning players, right? And I know that not everybody is going to have the same returning players and the same production from those returning players. You might only have, you know, in football, maybe you keep six players and maybe your conference rival keeps 14, but your six are way more impactful for those than those 14. Or maybe somebody else, everybody just decides to move on because they're tired of the coach. Or, you know, every situation is going to be a little different. Maybe to some degree, they are washed out across the board, but you're always going to have breaks that are more advantageous to some programs than others. It is going to be impossible to figure all this out ahead of time. So you're just, in a lot of ways, we're just going to have to kind of sit back and wait, and I think that's a good observation from you.
One other team that I want to bring up, I'm not sure if you have any other ones, was Texas A&M, because, I mean, they were, I don't know if polarizing is the right word, but there were a lot of strong opinions both ways on Texas A&M last year as they, you know, they got blasted by Alabama. They had the Florida win. Really, they only got that because of the fumble, but even if they lost that game, they played extremely well against a Florida team that was really good minus the whole shoe incident at the end of the year. And then they beat a lot of, like, meh teams. I mean, after that game, they beat Mississippi State, Arkansas, South Carolina, LSU, Auburn, Tennessee, and then, you know, you could talk about the bowl game if you want to. Now Texas A&M is coming back this year with the expectations that they will not only, like, stay in that spot, but, like, Jimbo Fisher was brought to Texas A&M to make the playoff. Like, he wasn't brought to Texas A&M to go 10-2. And they're expected to take another step forward, but, I mean, going back through, they were gutted by losses, and when you're getting paid what Jimbo is getting paid and what the expectations are around and within that program, like, nobody cares about roster turnover. I mean, talk about being fair. I don't know if that's entirely fair because we've seen what Clemson and Alabama have done, even Ohio State to an extent, to withstand those losses really in an unprecedented manner. We've never seen teams be consistently dominant like this in college football when you lose two-thirds of your depth chart and Nick Saban just says, okay, and then reloads. I don't know if it's fair because most programs can't do that. And almost no programs have done that historically unless you know, look at like 90s Nebraska, for example. But the point being, like, I think it's extremely fair. Like, if Texas A&M comes out this year and goes, I don't know how their schedule pulled up, goes like 10-2, I think a lot of people are going to say, well, they didn't take another step forward. And when we try to explain why things like that happen, it comes across as excuses. We can look at everything that Texas A&M lost. Their offensive line was completely gutted. They might not have great quarterback play after Mon left. But when you're getting paid what Jimbo Fisher is getting paid, I think the expectation is that you need to take a step forward. And I need to do more research on Texas A&M. But like, I don't think we're giving enough attention to, I don't know if A&M is going to be as good this year with all of these losses. And I think that's totally fair, but it's not going to be presented in that matter because of the perception that Jimbo was brought there to make a playoff for Texas A&M.
Yeah, I think to repackage something that you said, this is probably the year, 2021, this is the year that Jimbo was hired for, right? You've gotten yourself into position. Now you have to capitalize on that position. And you're 100% right about all the roster stuff. But as you said, if you're an A&M fan, you probably don't want to hear any of that. You just don't want to be Texas's little brother anymore. You want to make, you know, A&M jokes over the guys in Austin. Hey, you just got rid of your guy. You're going to be paying him millions of dollars to go away. We got our guy. We probably should have been in the playoff last year. That's what they'd say. I'm not saying that. Like, that's how A&M fans are going to think. And whether it's right-headed or wrong-headed is kind of beside the point. They're going to want to see a 1, a 2, a 3, or a 4 next to their team's name at the end of the season. So if you're Jimbo, you're probably earning that next contract this year. Fair or unfair? That's the game. We all know how it works. Is you've now established yourself in that five hole. You have established yourself as a playoff caliber team. You are a big Power 5 brand, so you are going to get the benefit of the doubt if you're good this year because you were good last year. You got to get it this year. You got to get it done, or you have to at least keep yourself relevant for 2022. That's just how the game works.
They only have 3 true road games this year. 3.
That's not bad.
I need to do more digging into Texas A&M, but this is the first time like I've truly looked at their schedule. And I don't know, like, with all these losses, if they can even navigate this, but it's basically Alabama at home and almost nothing else. You have Kent State, Colorado, New Mexico, and non-conference. Prairie View, A&M. Shout out to the SWAC. But neutral site games against Colorado and Arkansas, true road games against Missouri, Ole Miss, LSU, home games against Kent State, New Mexico, Mississippi State, Alabama, South Carolina, Auburn. Like, I think that that is going to look at as a schedule, like, you need to figure it out this year and prove that you've built the depth over, was this year 4? Yeah, this is year 4 for Jimbo, isn't it?
4 or 5, yeah.
I think it's 4 because Taggart was, yeah, I think this is year 4 for Jimbo. So I think even with that schedule, especially with that schedule now, the expectations will be even higher for Jimbo. And over the next 4 months, you and I will probably talk about it more, that Texas A&M has reached a point, whether or not you actually think they have, but they've reached a point where the expectations are, I don't care what your schedule is. I don't care what your roster turnover is. You need to make the playoff this year. Anything else before we wrap it here?
Yeah, I want to go back to Penn State really quick for a couple minutes. You said something earlier that we both said mid-season, which was, yeah, that Penn State team, something, 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 you know, they just quit on the season, which I think we all kind of looked around and, hey, said, we don't really love saying stuff like this, but this is kind of what it looks like. Penn State played 9 games last fall. Do you know what their final record was?
God, would they go 2-7?
4-5.
They went 4-5. I guess I just turned off Penn State.
That's what we all did.
What, 0-4?
They were 0-5.
They went 4-5.
And we all just went, whatever. They finished the season, the team that quit, again, not, I said it too. They finished the season on a 4-game win streak. And we all missed it because we were checked out.
Well, because they were... Because they were playing Rutgers, Michigan State,
right.
Illinois.
And so they beat Rutgers, and they beat Illinois, and they beat Michigan State, and I get that. They beat Michigan, which I think is not nothing, because Michigan, nobody ever knows how to talk about Michigan. They don't suck. Like, they're not bad. They're just not what people want them to be. They've got too much talent to be bad. They beat them by 10 in Ann Arbor. And if you look at the other 3 games they played Rutgers, they played Michigan State, they played Illinois. They won all those games pretty comfortably. And I'm trying to figure out, kind of like Indiana, what I want to do with Penn State mentally going into 2021. Like, do I just write 2020 off as a weird year where maybe they lost their best player before the season started because he opted out, and they have a funky start with Indiana and they just kind of got derailed out of the gate, but they figured maybe they did quit in the first 5 weeks of the season and they figured out how to unquit. I have no idea what to do with this season, But I do think it ended differently than we all remember. So I thought it was worth bringing up.
We're going to be back to our regular Monday-Thursday schedule. So we'll be back on Thursday, what is it, the 15th this week. It'll be available everywhere podcasts are available. Always appreciate the ratings and reviews on those on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you're listening. And always send any potential topics or mailbag, betting questions, anything to @HighMotorPod on Twitter. Specific betting questions to Chase. Just slide into his DMs on Twitter @ChaseAKitty. Thank you for listening to High Motor by BetMGM. We will be back on Thursday.
I saw a friend today. It had been a while. And we forgot each other's names. But it didn't matter, cause deep inside, the feeling still remained the same. We talked of knowing one before you've met, how you feel more than you see, and other worlds that lie in spaces.